Ms. Baer, good morning to you. We've got folks coming in and out of the courtroom, so let's give them a second. And I believe that has now been accomplished, so you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Julie Baer appearing on behalf of the appellant and the attorneys. My client was 16 years of age when he participated along with four other youth in the stabbing death. Mr. Jones entered a plea to the charge of first-degree murder, and he was originally sentenced District Court of Sarpy County, Nebraska, to a mandatory sentence at that time. Pursuant to the 2012 decision in Miller versus Alabama, my client became entitled to post-conviction relief and mandatory life without parole sentences were deemed to violate the Eighth Amendment under the decision in Miller versus Alabama. Mr. Jones then filed his application for relief that was granted by the District Court of Sarpy County, which then proceeded to vacate the original sentence and proceeded through the resentencing process. Ultimately, the District Court resentenced Mr. Jones, and it is from that sentence that we appeal today. Mr. Jones has now been incarcerated for 18 years and he is 35. Under the current sentence, he would be parole eligible at earliest. He is, of course, not guaranteed parole. He is not guaranteed to ever leave the confinement of the Department of Corrections. And if he is paroled, he will never be from confinement of parole by virtue of the fact that the top end of the sentence is. If you look at normal life expectancy, and it's been topic in some of these killer cases, normal life expectancy for someone residing outside the correctional system is 78 years. But for someone who is incarcerated, that figure drops to about 64. There's some thought that for someone who commences incarceration, that figure drops lower, maybe 6. So for Mr. Jones, if he is in fact paroled at the earliest opportunity, 7, that affords him, on average, and expectancy outside. And that does not constitute a meaningful opportunity.
Is life expectancy, is there case law that throws that into the equation, or is that common sense, or is that something that has simply been part of the arguments that everybody is making?
I think it's something that has been part of the arguments, and I think it is something that some courts are taking into consideration. In our case, there was an offer made, it's actually part of the presentation, life expectancy table, as well as some other documentation. Whether this sentence violates the Eighth Amendment is a question of law, and this court shall review the sentencing decision independent of the lower court. On review of a sentence claimed to be excessive, this court reviews under the abuse of discretion standard. Prior to resentencing, the district court did conduct a mitigation hearing. There was considerable testimony over the course of a couple of days. testimony from neuropsychiatrist, talked a lot about adolescent brain development, the adolescent brain is not matured and on in the 20s. We had testimony from Dr. Newring, who is a PhD psychologist who performed some extensive testing of Mr. Jones and determined that he was not significant risk for violence. We heard testimony from Jason Burtis, who was an employee at the department, testified observations while incarcerated, his behavior and rehabilitation. We also heard his sister, who testified as to his early home life, circumstances of his youth. The state presented no expert testimony or evidence.
What are you arguing the sentence should be?
Our argument at the time of the resentencing, I believe, was 45 to 70 years. Part of the problem that I see with these cases is there is no requirement of across the board, and several of those cases were referenced in my brief. We have different determinations being made by courts, equally, if you will, offensive, serious acts involving murder in the first degree or felony murder or similar situations.
How would we impose proportionality on these cases?
Well, I think it's important for the courts to be aware of the facts and circumstances of other cases. I think something that would help with proportionality is the requirement that there be specific findings made with regard to the statutory requirements and under the mandates of Miller and Montgomery and Tatum that the court actually engage in making a determination as to whether this person represents the rarest of individuals who is demonstrative of irreparable corruption, or if this person is demonstrative of transitional.
Was there evidence presented to the trial court at the mitigation hearing of proportionality, that is, the experience or sentences with respect to other defendants who were juveniles at the time of the murder?
I believe that I did hand Judge Arterburn at that time an up-to-date listing. A lot of those records are kept by the Nebraska Commission Advocacy, and I did provide that to the sentencing court, I believe, at the time of the sentencing hearing. Sentencing court.
And that's the same hearing as the Michigan study was. Okay. So those things happened at the sentencing hearing rather than at the mitigation evidentiary hearing. Is that correct? Okay.
This court rejected the notion in Garza that Tatum should dictate that there be no specific findings made. I would just say I think Jones is a different case than Garza, because Garza was a 90-to-90 sentence, Mr. Garza being guaranteed relief for 2 years with no parole, whereas Jones will never be free. And I think, in my opinion, you have a de facto life sentence when you have a top end that is life, and you have a high bottom end, such as 80 years, made without those specific statutory out the finding mandated by Miller. Reserve any remaining time?
Thank you. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent, I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Appalachia, the state of Nebraska. Jones filed his brief in this case before this court issued opinions in Mantich, Garza, Castaneda, Smith, and Nolan, and I mention that only to point out that there's nothing new in here. We've seen all of these arguments before, including the one that lifetime parole, about lifetime parole being cruel and unusual punishment. Nolan made the same argument in his case, and because it wasn't specifically addressed by the court, in that opinion, I'll touch on it here, but only briefly, because I don't believe it merits much discussion.
What is the effect of having the top end as life? Is there ever, a mandatory discharge date?
No.
So he could serve the rest of his time in prison?
Sure. Yeah, and that's the U.S. Supreme Court did not outlaw life sentences for juveniles, neither Graham or Miller.
Do they have to make any specific finding in order to provide for a life sentence?
Well, no. There's no requirement that they find that they're irreparably
corrupt. You're irreparably corrupt, isn't that a requirement?
For life without parole, correct. That's not what he was. And I think specifically, the way the court has analyzed it, in a situation where they provide life without parole, then you have to make the irreparable court that makes them findings.
You're saying if it were, so to speak, life to life, then that finding would be required.
Well, I'm not saying that's required, because they can't declare under Montgomery that they're not imposing that requirement. I didn't even, I remember reading Tatum when that came out, because it was right before it were argued. And I recall, I think the concern in that case was not that the court didn't make a specific finding of irreparable corruption, but that there was language that was used by the district courts in those cases suggesting they didn't believe that the juveniles were irreparably corrupt, so they sent it back for reconsideration. But I don't recall them imposing a specific finding requirement on the lower courts. But as I said, they didn't outlaw life sentences for juveniles, neither Graham or Miller. So it's not the length of the sentence that's problematic, rather it's the manner in which the sentence is to be served is problematic, and even then, potentially, because it's still possible for a juvenile to serve life in prison under both Graham and Miller. But the focus in both cases is clearly on life imprisonment. So when the court uses the phrase meaningful opportunity for release, it's referring to release from imprisonment, not release from custody, as that term is more generally understood. And you need not look any further than Montgomery to see that this claim has no merit. Montgomery, of course, was a case in which the U.S. Supreme Court applied Miller retroactively to all cases in which defendants were sentenced to mandatory life imprisonment for homicides they committed, that he or she committed as a juvenile. But in giving Miller retroactive effect, the court specifically found that a state is not required to resentence the defendant, but can remedy a Miller violation by simply permitting the defendant to be paroled. So clearly, parole is not the problem, it's the solution to the problem being life imprisonment. But again, essentially, even in Montgomery, the court suggested that there may be exceptional circumstances that render Montgomery's life sentence just as a punishment. If there aren't, the appropriate remedy is to afford him some years outside of prison, not some years free of any and all supervision. And the reason parole is offered as a remedy for a Miller violation is fairly obvious. Parole is far less oppressive than imprisonment, and it's entirely possible for a person on parole to lead a relatively normal life. So it's not enough to look at the duration of the punishment, you also have to look at the nature of it. Nothing in the nature of parole or in the United States Supreme Court cases that support a conclusion that the amendment requires the defendant to be on parole for a lifetime. That brings us to the only remaining issue here, which is whether Jones' sentence was excessive, or more specifically, whether the district court abused discretion imposing that sentence. We submit it did not. Conducted the requisite evidentiary hearing, considered all the relevant sentencing factors in light of the evidence presented at that hearing, as evidenced by its comments at the time of sentencing. I won't walk through those comments since they're block quoted in our brief, but suffice it to say that the sentence imposed was appropriate and supported by the record. If the court has any specific questions about the record, otherwise we would. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time?
She has 46 seconds.
46 seconds for rebuttal. Ms. Bear.
I want to just say that I think what's happening in these cases is without the requirement evidence regarding the offense is overwhelmingly inadequate. Jones is a textbook case of transient immaturity. At that time, 16 years old, noted IQ of 76, and he is participating in an offense that is very peer-driven. I think those factors combined with the Pope testimony that you do not have a fully developed adolescent brain until the mid-20s is a textbook case of someone who is unable, because of transient immaturity, to make responsible.
Thank you very much. Were you appointed in this matter? Thank you so much for serving.